Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is first-time co-host David Woken.
Hello.
Is that how you pronounce your name?
Yeah, actually, Woken or Walken are both accepted, but I say Woken because it's just easier when people see it written.
And you want to tell people out there a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So, I guess professionally, I am a librarian. I am the Latin American and Caribbean Studies librarian at the University of Chicago. I am the person who selects materials from Latin America for the University of Chicago's library collections. Prior to that, I also worked at the University of Oregon as their History and Latin American Studies librarian. And I was able to collaborate closely with their special collections, which actually hold our author Ursula Le Guin's papers.
Wow. Well, that's very fortuitous because this time we are doing the book you suggested, Ursula K. Le Guin's The Dispossessed from 1974. On this podcast before, I discussed The Lathe of Heaven. So this is the second Le Guin. One day I will probably get around to doing the Earthsea books because those are more in some ways in the wheelhouse of Sophomore Lit. But this is my first time reading The Dispossessed. Could you tell a little bit about your history with the book and when you read it first?
Yeah. I mean, I have a pretty long history of this book. I mean, I guess I first read it in high school, and I often will tell folks it's one of the specific pieces of pop culture, culture in general, that just warped my brain at an impressionable age. I'd been, you know, sort of a geeky loner kid who started getting into punk rock, first heavy metal and then punk rock in high school. And from there, that kind of led into radical politics. You know, you're sort of listening to Dead Kennedys and hearing Noam Chomsky samples on records and whatever. And then I start reading other stuff. And I don't know where I first heard of the book, but it came up exactly in that, of this kind of context of like countercultural radical politics. I bet I probably first heard about it on, there was a zine, now still does a radio show called Maximum Rock and Roll. And they had a couple of columnists. It's mostly about punk music, but they had a couple of political columnists. And one of them in particular is this guy who went by the name Lefty Hooligan, who did these very rich sort of theoretical and historical discussions of radical politics, which were sort of my first foray into that with any seriousness. And so I don't remember for certain, but I think I probably would have heard about this book through that. But I read the book and just absolutely fell in love. I'd read it a couple more times in undergrad. I was an anarchist. Of this mold, you know, a left-wing anarcho-communist young, you know, angry young guy who hated all hierarchy and authority and exploitation. And it kind of fed into my career. I went to graduate school after graduating undergrad, and I specifically to study anarchist labor movements in Latin America. So I bailed on a PhD, as many librarians, academic librarians do, bailed on a PhD before becoming a librarian. But that PhD had been about anarchist labor organizers in Buenos Aires in the early 20th century. So this book had sort of pushed me on this entire trajectory, right, that even went into my career now. And like I said, fortuitously, my first job as a librarian was at the university housing Le Guin's archives. It's just sort of like too perfect. So yeah, this book has been a very close companion. Although I got to say, till I read it back in probably like June or early July, it had probably been over 20 years since I'd read it. So it was a welcome chance to sort of revisit.
Right. Well, this is one of the books in what is known as the Haynish cycle of books that Le Guin wrote that share a sort of a common background. This and The Left Hand of Darkness are her most famous books in the series. Strangely enough, I have not read either of those books. Oh. I did read, as a young boy, I did read The Word for World is Forest, which I read because it was included in an edition of Hugo Award winners. And at the time, I found it baffling because I was a little kid and I was reading far beyond my range. I had read The Wizard of Earthsea, and I thought, well, this is going to be more of that, which it isn't. World for World as Forest is Le Guin's reaction to the Vietnam War, basically. Mm-hmm. And coming at this from an adult perspective, what I find really interesting just off the bat is Le Guin was the daughter of, I believe, an ethnographer.
I think both of her parents were anthropologists. Yeah.
Anthropologists. And her approach to science fiction is interesting. She sets up a sort of a situation that she doesn't really care about. It's really the Haynish cycle is based on the idea that at some point in the past, humans were dispersed around the galaxy. They've gotten out of touch with each other. They've developed different governments. They've even evolved slightly from each other.
Yeah, different and physiologies.
Now,
yeah.
Right. And now these disparate groups are coming together. And really what she's interested in is a thought experiment about one culture meeting another culture. Yeah. And so it's a very, very heady book, a very thought-driven book. It's not a book that has, from my perspective, reading it through the first time, the characters were a little hard to tell apart. There's a main character who's our protagonist, who is the noble anarchist, and then there's a bunch of people who kind of act as foils to him.
Yeah. And to some extent, it almost feels like older sort of 19th century, like social novels, realist novels, where people are almost types for their societies in some ways. Like one of the physicists who our protagonist, Shevik, feels a real intellectual bond with is an older aristocrat, essentially, and it very much I felt like the characterization was sort of her sort of explaining this kind of old money aristocracy and their attitudes, which some ways appealed to Shevik as an anarchist because he was sort of free to explore thought purely for its own ends, study physics for its own end because he found it interesting, but also he found utterly repellent because the man was sort of built on privilege, a really nasty kind of privilege, and had attitudes about, you know, his social lessers, about the nobility of war and and the needs of the state and things that Shevik just found utterly repulsive. But he couldn't. But he was also one of the few people he felt he could speak to as an equal intellectually. Yeah, and a lot of the characters in the novel have sort of similar sort of roles representing people in different parts of the societies that are just portrayed in it. For me, part of reading this and then also Left Hand of Darkness, I read immediately afterwards, which is also another book that, you know, really fundamentally reshaped how I thought about things. Part of what I loved about the Haynish cycle books is what you were saying, like that it is science fiction that is about social and cultural change, difference, interaction. The technology and the science element is there, but it's almost more social science fiction, you could say.
The technology, such as it is, focuses upon something of a MacGuffin in this plot of the potential development of simultaneous communication across space.
Yeah.
What they call, what is it, Ansible?
Ansible, right. And chronologically, though, this wasn't the first Haynish book she wrote. A lot of people say this is the first chronologically if you tried to write a history of the Haynish books, because this is all the others are built on the existence of the Ansible and the idea that once the different remnants of humanity make physical contact, they can then communicate even if they're separated by light years.
But the technology here is, it's like Star Trek technology. It's just, you know, it's the reverse the polarity technology.
Yeah.
It's
insert techno babble here.
Right. there's points in the book where she tries to make reference to the theoretical underpinnings of what she's talking about, and it doesn't work. You know, I think she should have just left it in the realm of black box. But that's not what she's interested in.
Right.
In this specific book, the story is about a dual planet system. You know, it's like Pluto. If you know, Pluto has a moon. It's not no longer a planet. Pluto is, but sure. The dwarf planet and its moon circle around each other. They kind of do this weird dance because they're so in influence of each other's gravity that they spin around each other. And that's the case with these two planets. What's it? Eurus and Anaris.
Yeah.
Right. Eurus is the it's a stand-in sort of for Earth, or at least it's a stand-in for capitalism. It's a stand-in for
it's Cold War Earth, essentially. It's a futuristic Cold War Earth.
Right. Most of this plot is taking place in an analog to Cold War United States, but there is this Cold War Soviet Union on the other side of the planet that keeps getting referenced.
I mean, as a historian, I thought of what is it, AI? I don't know how to pronounce it. I will say, what I love this book, but one of its biggest sort of just baseline problems is that it's sort of beholden to that old science fiction trope of coming up with unusual made-up names for things that are just impossible to remember and pronounce. And so that major capitalist power is, it's spelled A dash and then IO, like the Jupiter's moon, IO. And so I don't know, it's IO, IEO, AIO. I'm just going to say AIO. But like the way she describes AIO to me felt, yes, it was very US, but also very European, because she talked about it having a long history of, you know, essentially a medieval period ruled by a noble gentry. There are the remnants of ancient castles and things like that. So it's sort of Western Europe and the United States sort of mashed together in that way.
On the other planet, there is a colony. Somewhat 200, 300 years old from the main planet, made up of this group of anarchists who have been creating their own society for the last several hundred years. And as the story begins, our hero, Shevik, who is a theoretical physicist, is leaving behind the anarchist society to come back to the world of capitalism, of ownership, of government, because he is not able to publish his theories on his planet. And the people on the other planet are very keen on his theories because they are very exploitable. You know, it's a stranger in a strange land kind of setup. Shevik is presented as a very noble person. You know, he obviously we can see from the beginning of the book where Le Guin's sympathies lie, and she's going to make her protagonist, you know, with some rough edges, with some problems, a noble guy.
Yeah, and I mean, so the relationship between Eurus and Anaris is, I always found interesting. You know, part of the appeal for the book and why a lot of people who get into radical, anti-authoritarian, left-wing politics love it is because Anaris is not perfect. But at the same time, it feels plausible. It also feels in many ways desirable, but it is not perfect, and it has some very deep flaws. And in the setup, part of the idea is that, you know, Anaris has handed over that there had been this massive social movement of anarchists that was threatening the government of AIO and presumably other governments on Eurus. And essentially, they were at the brink of kind of, you know, a massive peaceful social revolution when they were negotiated into a stalemate and offered this other world, and then now are in a position that's almost a kind of semi-colony. That Eurus cannot tell the Anaristi what to do on their planet, but they do trade. And Eurus is a bountiful world, you know, rich ecology, you know, not unlike Earth, basically like Earth, right? Whereas Anaris, it supports life, but it's essentially a desert planet. You know, it's covered in scrub. The only major vertebrate life forms are fish in the oceans of the planet. And so it can't produce everything it needs. And so they end up essentially becoming a de facto mining colony. So Eurus can't tell them what to do, but they trade their precious metals to Eurus in exchange for, you know, computer, she mentions like computer parts, advanced machinery to replace, you know, equipment, things like that, that they can't get for themselves or make for themselves. So it's an interesting mix. And so when they see that also, that also means that, you know, the pursuit of, for Shevik, his pursuit of theoretical physics is not necessarily seen as, while he's free to do it, he also isn't necessarily, no one has an obligation to support him. And he can't really, a lot of people, very few people see the value in him pursuing this kind of pure theoretical perspective, whereas the Urasti, who are reading the papers that are being traded back and forth, they also trade to some extent scientific knowledge and things like that, start realizing that the implications of what he's working on could be profitable. And that's also why he's given an offer to come visit Uras.
Only after about a good 5 minutes of describing the political background of this book are you now getting around to Shevik's story, because that's the kind of book it is.
Yeah.
It's not as though Le Guin is disinterested in plotting. In fact, she has a very intricate chronology to this book. She has two timelines going on, and the chapters interleave. So one timeline takes place, what, years and years ago, and the other timeline is the now of the story. And eventually, by the time you get to the end of the earlier timeline, it's supposed to be the beginning of the newer timeline.
Right.
I feel, from, you know, from my perspective reading it through, that that approach has some strengths, but the problem I have with it is I feel like all the conflict is happening in the present day story, and all the Bildungsroman of Shevik's life is happening in the old story, and I feel like she might have been better served, or at least I would have been better served reading it through, if there were less of the prior story, because I kind of got the feeling like I got a handle on what Shevik's life was.
I guess I saw more of a story to Shevik, and that, again, that gets at why, as a piece of utopian writing, it appeals to me in a way that almost... You know, I got into different types of studying radical politics, many of which, well, all of which by a lot of perspectives will be called utopian, although I got to say, on the, you know, when it comes to left-wing philosophizing, utopian has a particular meaning, whatever. But, you know, utopian socialism versus, quote, scientific socialism and things like that. But one of the things I love about it, I mean, I've read a lot of utopian and dystopian writing, and very little of it actually... you don't feel it. It's always such a dry, mechanical, or I shouldn't say always. There's a few dystopias actually I do think have some actual narrative and emotional weight, but very few utopias that I've ever read. I can't think of any other. And whereas I found The Dispossessed very moving, both as a teenager and then now. I mean, there are parts where I was nearly moved to tears. And I think one of the values for me of those chapters on Inaris, both it is the utopian sort of describing what this kind of austere but caring and nurturing kind of free society would be like, but also setting up why Shevik once feels a need to leave. And so there is a plot through that of his constant sort of discontents, the limits he runs up against. And in particular, the value for a lot of people who are interested in utopian thought is that she's willing to recognize that the history didn't end, right? And in fact, a lot of the things they claimed that they had stopped still happen. I mean, Le Guin, you know, both World for World and Is Forced and also this book were inspired by her own involvement with 60s anti-war and feminist movements, you know, and she said that explicitly about them, and that her interest in anarchism grew out of getting involved in that. And she, you know, to me reading this, it was really obvious some of the specific anarchist theorists she had been pulling from. And when I read after the fact recently, just to see like if there was anything about that, she mentioned a lot of the names that immediately were going through my head as I heard her describe a few things. But particularly Peter Kropotkin, who's the Russian noble who gave up his 19th century, gave up his status, his title, and basically, you know, became a theoretical writer and philosopher in favor of anarchism, supporter of revolutionary social movements, and specifically wrote a book called Mutual Aid that is sort of argued on a scientific basis for the value of mutual aid as a sort of response to social Darwinism, that help among each other, collaboration was as powerful a force as competition in nature. And it became a very fundamental thing for anarchist philosophizing, sort of this idea that we are fundamentally competitive, saying, no, there's ways in which helping each other and collaborating makes us more fit, more able to thrive and survive. And anyway, I say all that because she has that, but also she clearly had run into some of the issues of that time. I mean, there's a famous essay in the 60s about the 60s social movements called The Tyranny of Structurelessness, and it was someone who was discontented with the way that, like, Students for Democratic Society groups, or, you know, in SNCC in some of their chapters, or other sort of 60s social movements, the kind of denial of hierarchy, the refusal to have structure, led to informal types of structure and informal forms of leadership and forms of abuse. And I feel like that is something that comes through really clearly to me as I read the parts about Shevek's life on Anaris, in particular where he butts heads with this scientist, fellow physicist, who's essentially become the gatekeeper deciding what science is worthy of publication. And it's not an official role. He's just a consultant for this rotating, randomly appointed council that makes the highest decisions necessary to coordinate production on Anaris. Anybody can be put on that council, right? Radically democratic in that sense. And anti-hierarchical, and their terms are limited and that you do not repeat. But it's random people, so they consult people who know things, and it turns out that there is a guy who, I can't remember his name, again, it's one of those names, something with a U, but anyway, who is sort of, has become de facto the man who decides what is real science on Anaris. And who, while he never explicitly says it, is jealously guarding this position, right? And Shevek butts heads repeatedly. It was really clear in those exchanges that, to me, that Le Guin had been around academia. The kind of fiefdoms that scholars will have, you know, that I can be the one who decides this is the real, you know, on that. And even if they're not getting, you don't get extra pay for it or anything, but it's just like, you know, you have your academic freedom and then you decide you are the person who must represent this field, this area of thought. That's what your identity is about. And for him, Shevek butts heads with that. And there's a bunch of other places. And the whole, as it goes, you get to this point realizing Shevek and his various friends, who for Anaris are kind of a bohemian sort, he runs into more and more people who, just because of social pressure and things like that, feel they don't fit in, even in this society that is free of hierarchy, has no prisons, has no jails, all that kind of stuff.
I believe you're talking about the character Sabul.
Sabul, that was it. Yes, he's the physicist. Yeah.
Partly because all through the book, Shevek is held up as this radical figure who absolutely is committed to the idea of absolute equality, of no hierarchy, mm-hmm. of no ownership. It's interesting to see a character like Sabul, whose ego is getting in the way, but who also believes that Shevek is problematic to their society, mm-hmm. because he sees there being implications to what Shevek is doing,
yeah.
that could lead to some sort of an evolution or even a revolution, right. into the politics, and that protectiveness that they have over their, what they think of as the perfected, society, is something that Le Guin, criticizes. That idea that you could ever arrive at a point where you've got it all figured out.
Right. And in fact, but that's one of those things. I was talking to another friend who I first met through similar sort of social movements, and is also a Le Guin fan recently. And both of us felt that Shevek, in some ways, is sort of the true anarchist in that sense, because he sort of recognizes that their eagerness to preserve their perfect world was undermining the perfection itself, like that the freedom and creativity they were supposed to foster was falling by the wayside. I also feel, at least that's the way I sort of read a lot of that, that his and his other friends, one of his friends ends up in a mental asylum after writing a play that everybody hated, and he was so crushed by the, you know, or not everybody hated, but enough people hated that he was just crushed by the response to it. Some people thought it was brilliant and funny, but he ended up sort of having a breakdown because of how poorly his art was received. And so, and there's all kinds of other folks who are sort of these oddballs and castoffs who Shevik eventually has around him, who, again, it's a free society, but it is built on a kind of radical sense of mutual interdependence and responsibility towards each other that leads to kinds of informal social pressure and things that he and his friends have to then butt up against. And, you know, and you see that also, like, at the beginning when he goes to the ship, there's actually one of the folks who mans the spaceport is, or who staffs the spaceport. I shouldn't say that because it's also Society of Radical Gender Equality. And in fact, that security staff, the only security staff on Aris, were, you know, men and women as well. But one of the security staff ends up getting killed by an angry mob that is watching Shevik leave because they've gotten this idea that they need to protect themselves from the evil influences of capital and the state and whatever else. And so, again, it's sort of this idea that even then they can then reproduce a kind of chauvinism or, you know, that they claim to oppose, even with their radical anti-nationalism, anti-racism, gender equality, whatever else.
Right. There was a line early on in the book that I actually loved, which was when Shevik has arrived on Eurus, mm-hmm. and he's looking around and he's surprised that people on Eurus are acting industriously.
Yeah.
There's this line, it's, he had assumed that if you removed a human being's natural incentive to work, his initiative, his spontaneous creative energy, and replaced it with external motivation and coercion, he would become a lazy and careless worker. And what I love about this is, of course, this is the traditional capitalist polemic against any non-capitalist form of government. They mm-hmm. say if you take away the profit motive, if you take away the chance for people to amass wealth, they won't be motivated to do anything, and the society will fall apart. And what's amusing is that Shevik assumes the opposite. He assumes that if you don't have a motivation from within to be a good person, you will be a bad person. But the thing about Shevik is he is radically open. Yeah. He looks around, he sees some of the advantages to this world. Mm-hmm. He definitely sees this being a world of wealth. And while a lot of that has to do with the fact that Eurus has all the natural resources, he also recognizes that there's opulence, that there is a certain kind of elan to the people there that he mm-hmm. admires in a way. He considers that against the very austere world yeah. he's come out of, and exactly. he sees a value in both.
Yeah, there's a kind of it's interesting because there's a mixture of austerity and abundance that he's used to that is not present on Uros. And so again, that they mention things like anybody can just go to one of the public, what do they call the, you know, the public cafeterias essentially that every settlement has on Anaris. You don't have to need any authorization. You don't need any money. You just show up, get some, they serve you food and you eat, right? And he's used to that. I mean, what they have is very limited. It's, you know, they mention that everybody's basically pescatarian, right? And the you know, there's some fruit, there's some sort of harsh sort of local grain that they talk about that they also use for construction and making clothes and things like that. There's the fish of the sea, which they do eat. But it's not a, you know, and there are, he does also mention that some cafeterias are known for having better food and more creative sort of atmosphere for the cooks who staff them. But getting to Uros, the just sort of riot of color and creativity and all that, is just, there's nothing like that on Anaris. So interesting, yeah, sort of for him, it's sort of the going from this free society, free of coercion and whatever, but very austere to one that he'd been told all his life was, rigidly hierarchical and exploitive, but was also just so colorful and alive in its own way that he was not expecting.
This is a good point that you bring up about the cafeteria arrangements, because for people who are looking at this from the outside, who may not be familiar with the sort of seriously political movement of anarchy, mm-hmm. they think of like anarchy to a lot of people who don't, who don't like the idea, see it as just mere randomness, and there being no, there, if people have no government telling them what to do, there will be no structure to society. Mm-hmm. But this is a society that in which people work in this interdependent way, and the idea is that you're always free to participate or not participate, mm-hmm. but it's probably in your best interest to participate in most of these things. And that includes things like food. It includes housing. There's a point at which Shevik, I think right after he gets paired up with his partner, what's her name? Takvar.
Takvar, yeah.
Right. They go to find a apartment arrangement. There's a line that when Shevik comes again to Yuris, trying to read a book on economics, mm-hmm. and Le Guin says that he can't read it. It's boring to him. It seems to him like some sort of a superstitious folk magic.
Yeah.
And I just don't buy that, because, anyone who's taken an introductory economics class knows economics isn't really about money per se. It's about scarcity of resources and who gets access to those resources,
right.
and how wealth gets created. And that's true in his society as well.
Yeah.
There is a pool of wealth that is being created, and it is being distributed using certain metrics.
These kinds of radical bottom-up democratic collaboration that they have through, they call them the syndicates, that sort of are the way they organize your society, in which you can free to join or leave. Yeah, which is the old, there's a whole thing called anarcho-syndicalism that's, she's essentially writing a society that's built on that concept. But although I understand your point there, there is something to be said for, you could wonder what level of economics book they gave him, if they gave him a basic textbook, right? Which maybe would have seemed insulting, but considering he came from a planet with a completely different form of economy, a freshman economics textbook might have done him some good to understand the world he was in now. But I actually read that. I thought that was interesting, because a huge portion of radical left politics, and not just anarchist, is about how capitalist understandings of value are mystifications, right? Like the entire opening of Marx's Capital, which a lot of people who try to read it just give up because they're like, what is he even talking about? But he's talking about how different types of value, right? And different ways we value things. He differentiates between like use values and commodity values, right? And he's from a society that thinks only in use value, right? And which you make no real claim for use value. There's a thing that you can use, but it's just a thing, and others have as equal a claim on it as you, right? Huge chunk of that argument early in Capital is about how they create these kinds of mystified understandings of value that take on a life of their own, the concept of commodity fetishism. And that's where you get things like dollars, currency in exchange, speculation, investment. Again, he's a smart guy. He probably could have understood that. But to me, reading that, it was kind of like, yeah, somebody who was raised with this radical, pragmatic understanding of resource distribution might find the complexities of capitalist investment and exchange just bizarre and baffling, right? That is the way I read that part, but I do get your point there, where he would just sort of be like, what is he?
Well, there's some funny things in the book. At one point, when Shevik is not able to get his book published, as we've said, because he's run afoul of the guy who is sort of the gatekeeper for the presses, his partner, I'm blanking on her name again, Sockverd, suggests that they learn how to set type. They're talking about movable type here, or at very least, or something like linotype, and that's not a trivial thing to do. I feel like the fact that Le Guin is not so interested in the specifics of the technology she's discussing they make me feel a little less confident in her assessments, because when Shevik is writing his theories, and he there's this point after he has had a disastrous sexual encounter on the planet, he's made a complete fool of himself. I mean, to be honest, he's probably assaulted this woman, yeah. But
he's also gotten incredibly drunk for the first time in his life.
But you know, to his credit, she doesn't really care. She doesn't. She's like, well, I have to change my dress because you made a mess of it.
She just finds it more embarrassing and uncouth than anything.
Right. Yeah. He says, I came here to do, I came here to do physics. And so what physics is he sits there and he writes out these formula that he's just coming up with by sheer force of will, I guess. And I
he's a purely theoretical physicist, and she even talks about his physics being partially about philosophy and ethics. It was very hand-wavy, kind of. You know, you get the point that there is a level of high-level physics where that might be just sort of purely working out the equations, but there's also a point where you do, even that does have a certain amount of empirical testing, right? I mean, that, you know.
Even Einstein was basing his thought experiments on actual observed phenomena.
That's exactly
I feel
right.
Like.
And we never get that sense from Shevik. Although maybe that's what because he's reading the journals that are being sent from Uras. So, but she doesn't lay that out. And you're right; it does just sort of seem like he just sort of deduces it from what he reads in other books. It's a very strange. I would also add, I mean, on that point, one of the things that I've noticed with other. I a couple years ago read a very sort of opposite kind of utopian science fiction in Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, which is essentially U.S. right-wing libertarians love it. And it's about a penal colony on the moon that fights for its independence from Earth. And one of the biggest issues I had with both and then also had reading The Dispossessed again is they both use a kind of hand wavy, we have these big supercomputers that help us distribute everything and figure it all out.
The thing that drives me nuts about Heinlein, and it even comes up in this book a little bit, is this idea that if you reach a certain level of intelligence and expertise, anything you do is forgivable, and you've arrived at this sort of a great, in Heinlein's case, I will use great man level.
That I think that's core to his appeal to right-wing libertarians, honestly, right?
There's a way in which all of Heinlein's characters are low-key John Galtz. You know, they're going to sit there and they're going to declaim at you. And there is a point late in this book where Shevik addresses a crowd.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, here comes the John Galt moment. But to his credit, he speaks a little bit more movingly about the interdependence of people.
Well, beyond my sympathies politically, I feel like that segment is a great example of where Le Guin's the better writer, and certainly has a better sense of, I don't know, human emotion, social life, personality. At least to me, like that speech in particular is one that still really gets me, which is, it's kind of almost naive, and it's, you know, he's speaking to an anti-war rally right before it gets violently repressed, and it's almost naive in its calls for solidarity and peace. But on the other hand, it's grounded in such a interesting philosophical perspective about shared suffering and responsibility to each other that I found really moving.
It really feels to me like a book written in the 70s. And oh, yeah. I was trying to figure out in my head what exactly the reasons were for that. And one of the things that I noticed is in chapter 9, there's a long section where the narrator, this narrative voice, is talking about what sex is like on Anaris, and a long description of how the equality of sexes and the relative freeness with which people approach sex as a contract you enter into with a person for as long as it is mutually beneficial to both of you has produced what she sees as this kind of a utopian equality in which both the pursuit of pleasure and the pursuit of a true mate can take place free from the trappings of marriage. But what is strange about it is it goes on for a long time, and I started to think, who is this voice? And who is this voice talking to? A lot of time is given over to explaining either the technology of a world or the economics of the world or the...
Or in Le Guin's case, it's cultural and social life for her. That's almost always the case. She'll go into these long digressions about these complex alien societies that she's creating.
But she, or the narrator, sure, or God, whatever you want to call, is saying this, and it's not clear. I mean, it's clear that she's doing it because she feels like the reader needs to know this. Yeah. But it's a strained kind of thing.
No, I was going to say, I guess it feels strained, but it to me, again, maybe it's also the familiarity with the intellectual tradition that Anaris is supposed to be trying to put into practice. That kind of discussion of free love and equality, sexual equality, is huge. And in particular with anarchists like, you know, Ursula Le Guin, or not Ursula, oh my gosh, Emma Goldman, who's also, again, reading this, I felt her presence heavily throughout the book. A lot of the anarchist feminist thinking in general. But also even among men who could otherwise be pretty awful in their gender politics, but were radically opposed to, you know, the rigid family and the ways in which it enslaves the people within it, including women, and is tied to property and wealth and privilege and power and that kind of stuff. That's essential. So I almost felt like it was inevitable. Like, if Le Guin's going to make this book about a functioning anarchist society, we're going to have to talk about sex, because that everybody else did, you know.
This is the fallout of the sexual revolution, mm-hmm. And in the U.S. you have the in popular culture, you have what I call the Playboy mindset, that yeah. We live in this cool, groovy world in which people can just do whatever they want. And the expectation is that everybody should be up for sex with anybody whenever it happens. And she's reacting, I think, to people, to writers like John Updike and mm-hmm. Philip Roth, who are writing kind of grossly sexual books from the male perspective.
Right.
You know, she's writing a book here in which there's a lot of matter of factness towards sex. And yeah. but it's not problematized.
No.
In fact, I mentioned before when Shevik gets drunk and throws himself at this high society woman, mm-hmm. who is the absolute cliche of a woman egging a man on at yeah. this point, because she's been flirting with him all night, she's been showing herself off to him, she's been absolutely doting on him as like, oh, look at the new guy from the other world, how interesting he must be, and showing him off to her other people at her party. When he throws himself at her and gets rebuffed, but you know, has an accident on her dress,
yeah.
She just kind of waves it off like, oh well, you know, this is yeah. she's not particularly concerned about it. So there is a little bit of that that particularly 60s 70s utopian idea that we make too much of a deal about sex and people shouldn't really concern themselves with issues of things like harassment or mm-hmm. whether women have to be available to men at all times because right. we're all friends here, I guess.
So that's an interesting reading of that. Because knowing Le Guin and her politics, that I don't think that's a takeaway she would have wanted anybody to take from this. But it does come through. I guess when I read that section, and I don't think it works as well as she wanted it to, although there's elements of this, is that, you know, she was interested in one of the, I guess another reason why this book, again, gets such serious treatment for its politics is she doesn't just stop at a description of sort of the formal economy and political structure of Anaris, but also the culture and the way it's changed. And so reading that almost to me was, and again, this also gets into some of the anarchist and feminist thinking about sex, where, again, questions of like class, exploitation, wealth, status, distort our own sex lives. And so part of the issue for him is that coming to Uros, he has no idea how to navigate sexuality and gender there. Right? It is so alien to anything he's dealt with before, you know, that sex is treated so matter-of-factly on Aris. Which isn't to say, which can also be, yes, you know, you just say no, right? But that's the thing. They don't make a fetish of it, is kind of the idea, is the sense I got of that. And when he gets to a planet that is marked by such rigid, you know, patriarchy and gender division, he has no way of understanding how to navigate it. You know, he doesn't get how to flirt in Urasti, you know, is the way to, maybe a way to put it, or to understand, you know, the types of friendliness and affection and, you know, even playfulness or something that a woman might have. And there's also a whole thing around how they dress, right? That, that also comes up, which I'm not sure what to make of that, but that, you know, the Urasti women are purposely much more, you know, made to be garish and attractive and whatever in a way that honor. But so it almost feels like to me it's like that it's him stumbling through this kind of mess of cultural and social norms that are shaped by this, you know, patriarchal capitalist society that he just has no idea how, you know, how that. And to me, what I'm getting at, I guess, is it's a part that's trying to get at, again, shows up in a lot of radical left politics about this concept of that economic and political exploitation can even reach into, you know, our psyches and our personal intimate lives. But I don't know that it actually, and I don't know that it actually works well as that, though. But that is that was my generous reading of that section.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to just say to the listeners, I realize that this episode is getting very, very heavy on the political theory. Sorry, this is the kind of book this is. But secondly, I do definitely get this strong feeling from this book that this is, as I get from all of Le Guin's books, that this is a very feminist work, but it is also a very much a second wave feminist work. Yeah. It's that wave of feminism from the 70s and 80s that was very focused upon equality of access to jobs, mm-hmm. safety for women from assault and health rights. And one of the things that marked that era of feminism was a strong distaste for traditional ideas of glamour, the idea that women need to make themselves feminine. And, mm-hmm. and I got the feeling that she was very disapproving of this woman, Vea is her name, because she represents all those, you know, the highly feminized roles that women take.
She's completely surrendered to patriarchy, but is reveling in it.
Right, and she's like that Phyllis Schlafly kind of point of view of like, oh, men think they run the world, but we actually run them, so it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And other people have pointed out other things that are limitations. I mean, I will say, reading it as a teenager, one thing I found really touching and moving, but I've also heard criticized, and I think rightly, was his Shevik's relationship with one of his friends. I think it's Badap, but I might be wrong about his name. But he has a friend who's gay, and they grew up together. They've been friends forever. And at one point, they've been apart for a few years because, you know, for various reasons, you know, Shevik had been off studying, Badap was off working somewhere else. But they meet up again in the largest city on Anaris, Abene, and for a brief period, they hook up. Right, Badap hits on him, or you know, they share a room and share, you know, intimate moments, and Badap makes an advance, and Shevik goes along. He says, "Okay, sure." But then after a little while, he just has to say, "I'm sorry, this isn't really working," and they stop sleeping with each other, and it's okay, and they remain very close friends for the rest of the story. And I gotta say, like me as a teenager, you know, I grew up in a small town in Illinois. You know, sort of early to mid 90s, reading this book where, you know, I'm straight, but reading a book where, you know, there's a character who, you know, a cis male straight character, not terms that Le Guin would have used to describe him, but absolutely is the case with Shevik, who is willing to share intimacy and try, you know, a relationship with his close male friend, and it doesn't work out, and it's okay. They break up amicably, right? And I found that really, I don't know, it was something weirdly touching. I think especially because I'd had friends who came out, you know, some of the first people in our small town and faced some pretty horrific bullying and whatever. And the idea that, you know, hey, maybe you could have a kind of just that kind of very straightforward relationship, and it doesn't have to be so fraught with danger and fear of rejection or even violence potentially, which I found really moving. I've also heard people criticize it though, because Badap is a relatively empty character in a lot of ways, and seems almost to exist to be precisely that, to be his sort of like creative gay friend who allows her to sort of talk about homosexuality for a minute and then move on.
Right. Well, I think again, second wave feminism really, de-emphasized the role of gender. It really thought that the way out for women was that they no longer should feel that any need to be feminine, and similarly that men should no longer feel any need to be masculine. So Shevik is completely egalitarian and is constantly bewildered when he comes to Anaris, because everyone there's such a gender disparity, and that people expect you to have opinions about women that he doesn't have, and he finds those absolutely bewildering. I think this idea that we could arrive at a perfect world by relinquishing sort of the idea of gender as a category, it really marks that as a sort of a 70s feminist style. And I think it's certainly not what most people on the left feel today. Certainly the younger generation, gender is seen as very important, and to the point, you know, this is why, you know, I'm going to open up a can of worms here, but this is why I always feel like older feminists sometimes run afoul of younger feminists when it comes to trans rights, because older feminists just don't understand why gender is even a thing.
Yeah. Well, there's that. And also my understanding from having read a lot of Le Guin, including nonfiction works that she did, that she wasn't rigidly one of these, but there was an element of second wave feminism that not just that, but also kind of embraced sex to the point where being, which I think is also part of the challenge about dealing with sort of transsexuality and things like that. They essentially an essentialized understanding of woman, but we're women and womanhood that is sort of the flip side of patriarchal denigration, right? No, it's positive. It's nurturing and collaborative and all that we should be, you know, and then you had these kind of radical feminist communes that formed where, women went off to live among themselves and be, you know, you could be a full woman of your own there and that, which is, does, I think, sort some of that biological, sexual, maybe is a way to put it, essentialism, does come through in this, and even a book like Left Hand of Darkness, which is very much about gender fluidity. But she'll just say things offhandedly about, like, I know in Dispossessed at one point, they talk about, this is one that comes in a lot of her books, but I know it comes up in Dispossessed, about offhandedly mentioning how men were capable of great feats of strength, but women could endure hard work longer. Just this sort of idea that, like, there were these inherent differences is still there. I would imagine if a young Le Guin wrote basically this book, but with contemporary understanding, instead of having this kind of austere, free, but, you know, basically gender binaried society, right, where it's men and women, gender on Inaris might still be austere, but would also, or life on Inaris might still be austere, but gender would instead be just an incredible rainbow of possibilities, right? Instead of no gender, it's whatever you want to do with gender, right? Assuming you're not hurting other people. And that definitely, there's nothing, no understanding of that, of like, you know, people choosing to express in whatever form they want, regardless of biology or how they've been treated by others or something. yeah, that is an interesting sort of element. And I think that's one of, that comes up in regularly in her work. She is very much, while she is much less rigid and again, has that kind of small L romance language style libertarian streak through her work, she still has certain understandings about sexuality that are so very rigid compared to, say, like, you know, similar authors who would be working today.
Well, we've run through about an hour here, and mm-hmm. it occurs to me that the amount of time that we've spent talking about the politics of this book,
sure,
is about it. 9 to 1 to the plot of this book.
It's hard not to. It is very much like a novel of ideas, and right. for better or worse.
Right. I will say that about this as a first time reader. I found it very engaging, and I found it very. In the end, I found myself not really caring whether Shevik was going to discover the secrets to simultaneous transmissions.
No, that's all by the wayside. That's on no point.
I don't want to scare anyone off of this book if you feel like you really need to hang your hat on character and action, because things happen in this book. There is a through line, and it's a fairly complicated story by the end, and we haven't even begun to talk about the very end, the Hainish people show up in for just the last chapter, basically,
right.
And Terran people show up also for the last second to the last chapter.
They've been mentioned throughout that there were other aliens, but yeah, it's at the end when Shevik has finally come to the end of the hospitality of his Urasti hosts that he has to flee to the Terran embassy to save his own life.
There's political turmoil going on. There's been a coup that happens in the background. There's a lot of stuff that happens here, but I think anyone who reads this book will probably come away mostly thinking about the ideas that it brought up in this book.
Yeah, you come away with a sense of the worlds in them, both, you know, the possibilities and limits of Inaris and the glories and horrors of Uras. And more so than, and to the extent, like I mentioned, a few sort of character moments that have always struck with me, but it's almost because of the roles they play in explaining those places, right? Like the relationship with Badap, or, you know, the conflict with Sabul, or things like that.
Any last words before we shut the book on this one?
No, I'm going to have to say no, because I probably could. I've tried to be clear up front that I am a bit of a fanboy for Le Guin and this book, although I am very cognizant of its limitations. But I mean, it is, I agree with you that I highly recommend it. It is a book of ideas, but it is beautifully written. It flows wonderfully. Like, and it, And again, as I said, compared to so many other science fiction books that try to talk about politics or economies or things like that, there is a real heart to it. And there's a real, at least to me anyway, there's a real sense of you know, describing real people and worlds that feel, to, at least to me, I've always felt very alive with possibility in a way that, you know, a lot of other science fiction can be mechanical or empty. And that's always been Le Guin's real strength, whether she's writing something very political or not, is that she is a science fiction writer who has the kind of eye for characters, for people, for humanity that really sets her work above a lot of other work.
Thanks to my co-host, David Woken. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com or join the discussion on the Sophomore Literature Facebook page or the Sophomore Literature Incomparable Membership Slack. And whatever you do, keep up on the reading, because as always, everything will be on the final.